This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
How bad is it? Even scientists can't grasp the reality of what is happening on this planet. Trying to figure out where we are, where we really are, 17 expert scientists pored through over 150 essential papers. Their summary, published January 13th, is called Underestimating the Challenges of Avoiding a Ghastly Future. That seems pretty clear. The lead author, Professor Corey Bradshaw, is the Matthew Flinders Fellow in Global Ecology at Flinders University in Australia. From Adelaide, Corey, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
We can't see this COVID-19 virus, but it has trashed our economies and our personal lives anyway. And we can't see into the future of the environment either. But almost 2 years ago, you and I talked about the rules of extinction. What got you going on this new paper with the Ehrlichs and a whole crew of other great scientists?
That's an interesting story. We had started chatting about this probably over 2 years ago. The idea that we all agree that things are bad. We all agree that we're having trouble giving that message to basically the greater public. But also there seems to be quite a few of our colleagues who, probably because of their individual specializations and the fact that they're all terribly busy, can't quite grasp all of the connecting parts in this complex adaptive system that really work to create a kind of perfect storm of circumstances that we say in the paper will lead to a ghastly future. So we really wanted to hit a few things on the head simultaneously. One of them was, you know, it's beyond just the biodiversity loss. There's a lot of other components in the system that we need to take into account. That single solutions, there's no silver bullet. We've talked about that before. And that the prognosis is pretty dire because none of the signs are pointing in the right direction. And we just wanted to sort of lay our cards on the table and say exactly what was going on and not try to gloss over any of the challenges.
Well, I do talk with a lot of scientists on the show, and one may tell us coral is dying, another talks about disappearing insects, as you say. And I wonder, well, where are the scientists who are tallying this all up and getting the big picture? I thought the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change would do that, but they've been really, really conservative and careful about what they say, and I'm not sure that I trust their results in total.
Well, I mean, you can trust the IPCC insofar as they are mandated to make all of their uncertainties up front, but we've actually published work last year that shows that these uncertainty statements actually accumulate throughout the document and overestimate the uncertainty for particular phenomena that are very well established scientifically. So because of this conservatism in getting all the signatories on board, the language of the IPCC, and to a certain extent probably the IPBES, which is the Inter-Policy Platform for Ecosystem Services and Biodiversity, or Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, similar concept, that they tend to inflate the uncertainty because of this political sensitivity.
Well, I know that scientists do have difficulty translating technical work to the media, and the media has their own agenda and bills to pay, and the listeners will have belief buffers, we could call them. Corey, is it possible we've arrived at a threat that can't be communicated properly?
Well, as we state in the paper, the idea that environmentalism in general has become associated with a particular political ideology and has been weaponized by certain other ideologies against largely, you know, left-leaning or progressive politics, despite the fact that environmental degradation affects us all equally. Well, I'll qualify that. If you have a lot of money and you live in a place where there is some semblance of government regulation and you can isolate yourself from some of the more imminent effects, you will be somewhat immune to the effects of an environmental cascade that the poorer or more exposed population will not. So if we always say, too, that, you know, because of this weaponization of environmentalism, that it has become associated with not just the politics, but also the policy implementation. So even if it tends to benefit everyone, it's viewed as simply a political preoccupation as opposed to a way to promote self-sustainability. And that applies across the board. I always argue that the true libertarian, so the one who shuns all forms of government and tax and wants to be left alone and not mandated in any way, so the ultra-conservative libertarian, if they were logical about their points of view politically, they would become the most, some of the strongest environmental advocates, because whatever their neighbors do to their properties will affect them environmentally. So, for example, let's say I own some property and my neighbor poisons her river, and that river flows through my property. I'm therefore going to be affected negatively by it. So if I don't want any interaction or interventions from other people or effects from my neighbors, I should be strongly supporting environmental legislation. But it's in fact quite the opposite because of this weaponization.
Yeah, do you think, I mean, climate is finally reaching the top of the agenda in some countries, perhaps not in yours, but do you think that this climate concern has hidden some of the things that you specialize in, the ongoing loss of living things here on Earth?
Yeah, well, again, as a conservation biologist, we consider all of the threats simultaneously, and climate change is one of many. So up till now, most of the extinctions that have happened have been because of habitat loss. And most of that habitat loss has been because of agricultural expansion to feed our population. And that's slowing down some areas, and it's speeding up in others. And it's also a question of death by a thousand cuts, because even if you have a government that comes in and puts in a good policy, not only is it impossible to reclaim the losses that have happened since the previous administration, unless you've got, you know, massive restoration in place, but the next policies that come along that change that, for example, anti-clearing laws and allow people to develop and knock down trees and destroy habitats, you know, even if you come back to a more preservationist policy afterwards, you've already done the damage. It can take, you know, 300 to 1,000 years for a forest to get back its original ecological functions, including everything from water storage, carbon storage, soil health, and the infrastructure available for all the different species that live there. So even if you have changed your government like you have just done, like the Americans have just done in their country, the damage has been done in a lot of cases. And so every time we move forward politically, we've already taken two steps back for every step forward.
And I know that your paper reviews the known state of corals and wetlands and biodiversity and mammals and plants and insects and more. Can it all decline at once, Corey? And then what replaces the vacuum?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Something that's, in fact, we've got some research coming out shortly that talks about this, and some of the work that I discussed with you last time we spoke about extinction cascades. So the fact that we are the primary extinction, so those extinctions that happen because of direct perturbations, for example, cutting down a forest, they're only really the tip of the iceberg, because all the other species that depend on them also decline and will go extinct. In fact, this concept called co-extinctions might account for most of the extinctions happening in a mass extinction event. Now, what is a mass extinction event? As we explained in the paper, that geologically that's considered to be something above 75% species loss within about 3 million years. Now, about 3 million years is a long time from our perspective, but it's a geological heartbeat. Will we get into the scenario of that kind of loss? Probably. Will it be well within 3 million years? Yes, perhaps even substantially faster than that. But even if, say, even up to 90% of all life collapses on the planet, including us, will the planet be in trouble? No, in the long term, of course not. It will come back. New species will originate. There will be a lag time, perhaps 2, 3, 10 million years thereafter to recover. But there will be a recovery. What we're really talking about here isn't planetary. You're not worried about the planet per se, at least on the geological time frames. You know, from the perspective of Earth, the only thing that really threatens life is the explosion of our sun, which probably won't happen for several billions of years. So the planet's fine. It's our human society that's in trouble, and that's what we're really talking about. And the ghastly future we're talking about is the ghastly future our children and their children will experience, and their lifestyles and their standards of living will decline as a result.
Your co-author Paul Ehrlich, also a guest on this program at one point, made his name in the late 1960s with the book The Population Bomb, and that was written with Ann Ehrlich. In 1970, the population was half the current 7.8 billion humans on this planet. Why has population somehow dropped out of climate activism and other environmental work?
Well, I think partially because population has been seen largely as a preoccupation of wealthy Western societies that are dictating terms to developing nations. And so it's become a little bit politically incorrect to talk about. It's starting to come back into the conversation because no matter what your perspective, there's no denying that the number of people is and consumption, they're co-concepts that can't be separated. But those two things together are responsible for pretty much all of the problems we're seeing today. And as we outlined in the paper, not just for biodiversity, but for general standard of living and the probability of dying horribly. So population is something that has to be addressed, but it can be done in politically sensitive ways. Now, there was work that came out about 3-4 years ago showing that, you know, at least in Western societies, that for all the personal decisions you can make regarding diminishing your footprint, by far and away, by an order of magnitude or more, the best thing you can choose to do is not to reproduce. Now, you can avoid overseas flights, you can eat, you can become a vegetarian, you can buy an electric car, but nothing comes close to not reproducing, simply because of the accumulating effect of adding individuals that consume into the population. Are we going to see a massive population drop in the near future in time to see any decline really in the overall consumption rates? No, that will probably take centuries, not decades, to achieve. Can we lessen the effect that more people will have on the planet and all the negative corollaries of that? Yes, we can, but it doesn't mean that we're going to avoid some form of a ghastly future. I like to tell people that what gets me out of bed in the morning isn't so much that I'm going to try to stop catastrophe. I'm just going to try to make it just a little bit less.
I may have to bleep out that word. All right. I see that politicians watch their next election. Dictators watch their backs. Big lobby money flows in like water. I wonder, can our form of government actually respond to the real implications that you found evidence for on a dozen deadly fronts? What do you think?
You know, apart from a complete restructure of the economic system that currently exists in most countries, which isn't going to happen overnight, being labeled a left-o pinky commie bastard is something that I've received several times. But really, what probably some of the easiest changes we can make to our socio-political systems are achievable with the stroke of a pen, and that really is making political donations illegal. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that that could be done as simply as that. There's a lot of ins and outs that it's a bit beyond my pay grade, really, because I'm not a political scientist. However, it's a fairly straightforward fix. If you can divorce the money from the decision-making, then you're going to end up making democratic decisions that benefit more people and not simply corporations. That is the number one thing we can do as voting public, and pressure our political parties and how to do that. Now, there's obvious reticence to do that because no one likes to stop an income source, and a political party is no different. But we must demand this because any political decision-making that is dependent on who pays the most money and therefore has the most influence. You don't have a democracy, you have a plutocracy. In fact, I would argue that there isn't a single country on the planet that has a true democracy. We are all shades of plutocracy. Now, that's doable. And capitalism could persist in that system, not exactly like it is today, but it wouldn't be a complete overhaul. The next thing I think that would need to be addressed, and this is a little bit more extreme, but I personally think that the worst human invention ever made was incorporation and the public listing of companies, because it takes all decision-making and divorces it from human morality entirely, because the board's primary objective, and only objective really, is profit maximization for the shareholders. When you do that, you avoid any sort of moral or, I guess, societal benefit decision-making at the complete expense of every aspect of human decision making for profit maximization. Now that's not a popular opinion, but if we could somehow get rid of or at least vastly reduce the stock market and how people invest, then we might have a little bit more of a chance of reducing how ghastly the future might be.
It's shocking to hear you talk like this. I mean, can scientists talk about this kind of thing? I thought your role was to calculate some evidence and publish it and stand back.
Well, that clearly hasn't worked, has it? I mean, scientists are getting more bolder all the time and saying, look, we're at the forefront here, and to use a really terrible pun, the coalface, that we see what's happening in front of us, and it can be a rather depressing job. I liken it to being a paramedic who sees death and destruction every day and then takes that home with them and then suffers PTSD as a result. A lot of my colleagues suffer depression as a result of this. So you feel impotent, and you need to do something beyond simply reporting the demise of society and the planet. What we have done, therefore, is expanded into other elements of the complex adaptive system that is human society and looked for empirical evidence of how things are related and, more importantly, how one could intervene to change those. That requires an excellent understanding of human psychology, political science, and human behavior. Those are not my specialties. However, I am certainly starting to work with one of these specialists to see if we can come to some sort of multidisciplinary approach to solving some of these very wicked problems.
Yes, I would love to see psychology brought into this and communications. I wish psychology were a little more advanced than it is. We don't really have a grasp of how our minds work, but we have some clues. Certainly advertisers use what they know against us. Perhaps we could use that to communicate what the future really looks like and how we can soften it, at least, as you say.
Yeah, and that I think that's the key. I mean, a lot of my colleagues in pure sciences, biological sciences, will fully admit that the science is done. You know, we can get more precise estimates. We can always find small successes here and there. But generally speaking, we know what needs to be done. It's about how we do it now. And that is a question for the social and economic sciences. It's not a question of science per se, because we're dealing with human societies.
I note that Anne and Paul Ehrlich have been saying one thing for years: educate women and give them more power. What does that have to do with saving coral or slashing CO2 emissions?
Well, that's actually a fairly straightforward one. Much of the female population on the planet is living within an institutionalized patriarchy and therefore sexism that basically makes the decisions from the perspective of the male involved in the relationship. Now, if women do not have control of their own reproduction or their own finances, then they're at the mercy of someone else's perspective. And if women were empowered to the extent that is possible, and we know it's possible because it's happened in many countries, then we would see fertility rates drop markedly in many countries where they're sort of at the highest possible level, for example, places like Nigeria. The empowerment of women also includes not just reproductive control, but also economic independence. And it's been well established that supplying finances and freeing up the economic situation of women leads to better investment choices that are more sustainable in the long run. I mean, there's an old... not really a joke because it's not funny, but it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek way of expressing that if you give money to people that are living in poverty, that much of the money, if you give it to the man, will go towards prostitution and drinking, whereas if you give it to the woman, it will go to feeding her children. Now, we know what's better for the planet. Some other work we have coming out soon shows that the number one determinant of reduction in fertility across countries is reducing child mortality. So clearly, anything that promotes child survival is also going to reduce fertility and therefore get a little bit more on top of the population issues.
Now, all this sounds pretty awful for other people somewhere else, but I don't believe it will hit me directly, and that's the kind of inbuilt optimism built into most of us humans. What do you think, from your in-depth review of science, should we expect things to get better?
Well, I think the pandemic is a perfect example of how environmental destruction can affect all of us. And it has, as you said in the beginning of the interview, it's crippled economies and killed millions of people. And it's not, we're not out of the world here yet. We have somewhere to even look at vaccine. The problem is making that link to the environmental degradation that is ultimately the cause of these viruses shifting over from animals to humans. We've been warning humanity about pandemics for decades, and some of them have happened already. This is probably the best example of that. Will they happen again? Of course they will. Will they happen more frequently? Most likely. Will they be as virulent? We're unsure of that component. But when you see economies on their knees and people dying in droves and mass graves, you really have to be thick not to make the link to our environmental predicament. Now, it's also things like natural disasters, which are a little bit more in your face. In Australia, last year, we had the worst bushfires in our history. And, you know, it was a real turning point in Australian politics. But then the pandemic came along, and we sort of forgot about that. But bushfires are only going to get worse and worse. Bushfires in California, bushfires in the Amazon, bushfires in Russia. Just some of the things. We haven't even mentioned cyclones. We haven't mentioned sea level rise. But all of these things are making life worse for people. And just talk to the insurance industry. They've been on top of this stuff for decades because of money's involved.
Whenever a public figure is arrested, even for a heinous crime, it seems to me, the news media usually runs a nice bio photo with the story, you know, a suit and tie, rather than their mugshot disheveled. And I hear you warning scientists may be doing the same thing. What are you calling for in the science community?
Well, I think generally in the science community, what our main message here is that no one discipline, no one expert, or at least one solution is going to fix the problem. We have to realize that we are within this complex system, and we have to work beyond our comfort zone. And we also can't avoid imparting some sense of doom and gloom in our work, even if that there is the danger of turning people off. Because, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of people just sort of say, look, I don't want to hear about the bad news anymore. I'll just have a glass of wine and forget about it all. But unless we're absolutely clear about the magnitude of the challenge, all of our efforts will come to very little, and we will unfortunately miss the boat. And that's what we're concerned about.
By the time a science article is reviewed and published, you're already working on something else, I'm sure. What is on your agenda, Corey Bradshaw?
Well, the next step, obviously this laid bare quite a few problems and didn't offer a lot of, you know, solutions, because the solutions, well, one, we didn't really have the space to talk about solutions, but two, the solutions are very complex in their own right and extensive. So our next steps are to try to do exactly what we were just discussing earlier about amassing experts within these particular fields that understand more about human behavior and society, and try to put together a very prescriptive, applied approaches to fixing systems and doing the easy stuff first. Because if there is a pathway and it's empirically supported, then there's a higher likelihood of uptake at the political level. You know, we can't force politicians to do that because they're beholden to their constituencies. However, if we provide not quite so vague recommendations, we give them an actual recipe or a roadmap for how to do these things, then we might get a little bit more traction. So that's certainly the next step.
As we wrap this up, Corey, is there anything else you would like to say to our listeners, like maybe a lifeline in the storm?
Well, I said earlier, the thing that gets me up in the morning is to try to make sure that my daughter's life, while I'm convinced it won't be as rosy as it is now, but it is not quite as ghastly. And, you know, anything we do, any small successes we have should indeed be celebrated. I'm not suggesting for a moment that we should just throw up our hands and say it's all for naught, because it's not. Anything that we do that's positive is good. However, what we need to realize is that if we just continue down the path of, you know, okay, I recycle and I take the bus, that's not going to be enough. So try to do what you can and try to exert your democratic rights to put in some of these vast sweeping changes to policies and political processes that will benefit our future generations, our children. And, you know, anyone who is a parent will know this straight up, that the last thing you want for your child is for them to suffer. And anything we can do to prevent that is a good thing.
We've been speaking with Dr. Corey Bradshaw from Flinders University in Australia. He is the lead author of the paper Underestimating the Challenges of Avoiding a Ghastly Future, published January 13th. Find links to the paper and a good introductory article in The Conversation in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Corey, I always appreciate talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.